Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing and rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about prototaxites, which is a new word to me, so presumably it's a new word to some of you. These are living creatures that existed before dinosaurs and before even trees. They were very interesting, and an Irish researcher has been studying all about them. We'll be hearing about that in a bit. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of the comments at the end of the podcast. First up, time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Associate Professor of Chemistry at DCU, Susan Keller.
Full title today.
I know.
I'm an associate professor as well. Why don't I get my title?
I don't know. I think because it's funny. I don't know. Shane, our first story has to do with something that I would have thought was obvious. Just thinking about it for 4 seconds. The problem with mental health diagnosis.
I would have thought this was absolutely understood as well and well established. And what we're talking about here are the diagnostic tools that psychiatrists and psychologists used to diagnose mental health disorders, things like depression, anxiety, bipolar and personality disorder, or addiction things, right? So what happens is, the first thing is to say there are no biomarkers for any of these. You can't take a blood test and it'll give you some sort of a signal that says, yes, you are bipolar or you have depression or any of those things. Instead, what happens is a professional has to ask you, take you through an interview and ask you a series of questions. And from that, and of course your responses, they're able to diagnose you with something or not, right? This is the same way that issues of neurodivergence are dealt with as well. So like issues like autism and so on. But this study is shown from McMaster University in psychiatry, done by Lara Duncan. I had to look at it twice. Is this Lara, Lara from our show? But it's not. What Lara Duncan has done here is looked at the reliability of a test. So they looked at people who had been tested between 2024 and 2025, and they looked for test and retest reliability. In other words, if I was a psychiatrist and I asked you a series of questions and then you were diagnosed with whatever and Susan came in the next day, she's also a psychiatrist, and she asked you the questions, how reliable would the outcome be? And they found that there is a great deal of doubt, right? That they were not as reliable as perhaps we were led to believe. And they use very statistical tools in order to talk about the reliability in question. I think it's a little shocking that I would have just thought that was the case anyway, because these things are not, there's no objective thing. So I'm going to ask you perhaps, like, how many of the last 7 days did you feel sad or anxious? Like, they're very subjective things, right?
They are, but they're not necessarily even subjective to me. But then, of course, there's the act of the observer, right? If the psychiatrist who's asking a question is a man, and it's a big room that the person feels uncomfortable in, or it's a woman that they know very well and have been, you know, working with for such a long time and they feel very close to, are they going to have the same answers? Of course they're not.
What's interesting to me also is that the response, at least in the media, from the psychiatry profession to it has been to double down and to basically say, this is interesting, but we need much more statistics on what you're talking about. We want to know more about what you're doing, rather than sort of think, okay, if we're not getting the reliability that we thought that might be there, are we sure this is a valid way of measuring these things?
Well, I guess there is a danger in saying, well, just because there's variability in how mental health conditions are diagnosed, you know, the whole system is flawed and broken. We should, you know, throw it out.
I think, of course.
I think we operate in this way for reasons, because for many, it's efficacious. But, the variability of experience, memory, current mood, I would imagine, would throw your responses.
You're looking for, I think, the same sorts of certainty and validation that you might if you were to go into your cardiologist and say, I get palpitations. Yep. You are craving an expert to guide you and tell you what to do. The sad reality for people that in this space is that it is often far more environmental, and there are many complex issues that are going on that are the wraparound support you need for mental health issues. Mm. I think for me, this is a real indication of what happens when you take scientists who become doctors, who specialize in something that is ultimately not really that scientific, and you get them to use scientific tools only to measure people's mental state, as opposed to a far more, and people do this, a far more sort of inclusive approach where they'll use the tools that we've described, but they'll use other things as well to understand what's happening in people's lives. So talking as well as sort of measuring things and giving you pills.
Look, flippant and sort of, you know, this is a skim over something. I would love to hear from those who work in the profession, you know, how confident are you in the diagnosis of someone else using these tools to diagnose these sort of conditions? Because, you know, it is a field I only know a little bit, you know, at the edges. So love to hear from you to get your thoughts on that paper. Our second story has to do with Artemis, and this is the next step in our journey to the moon.
Yes, Artemis 3. And the big news this week is that NASA have named the astronauts that are going to take part in this. And I suppose Artemis 3 was originally going to be one thing, and it's changed into another thing, but the astronauts still have to be selected, and we'll go into details on the changes between the programs in a minute. But the main people who've been chosen, it's an all-male crew, dissimilar to the last one, and they include in command Randy Bresnik, who is, I mean, I have to say, all of these people are amazing, right? I mean, astronauts are just phenomenal. So Randy Bresnik is a Marine colonel. He's a former commander of the ISS, so he's well used to going up to space, and he's got 7,000 plus hours of flying. Also, interestingly, he's one of only two astronauts ever to have a child born when he was up in space, so he missed that moment. The pilot is Luca Parmenato, is an Italian fighter pilot out of ESA. He's already spent over a year in space, including time on a spacewalk in 2013. When I was researching this. This is phenomenal. Where he nearly drowned when he was on a spacewalk up in space because water started filling up his helmet from a filter from his cooler had misfunctioned, and therefore water filled up. So he did, it's a great story if you're interested in that, how he got back. So he's well used to being in a tight spot. So he's going to be super here. And the two mission specialists are Frank Rubio and Andre Douglas. And Frank is an Army Black Hawk pilot and a flight surgeon, and Andre is a systems engineer, and this will be his first space flight.
Oh, so, good. I was hoping that somebody would have it, you know, for the first time.
Yeah, like, he's
already been loads in space. How come he gets to go to Artemis 3? So, but the interesting thing is that the changes, right?
The changes.
So, has Trump anything to do with the fact that these were an all male group?
You know? No, I don't think so. Okay. I would hope that they're selected for what it's needed on the flight.
Yes,
and I think that's the same with anything, of course, with spaceflight. So the difference is, originally Artemis 3 was to go to the moon and to land on the moon. But the problem was that the landers weren't ready yet. And so instead of sort of delaying everything, they said, well, let's just turn it into something where we can test them locally. So they're testing them. They're testing the two landers, one from Blue Origin and one from iSpace. And they're going to test them in this low Earth orbit, which is around 400 kilometers up rather than 400,000 kilometers, which is the distance to the moon. So it's a little bit easier. And they're going to be testing docking procedures, life support, and all the make or break systems that
would
that
suck
need to
though
be,
wouldn't it? You thought you were landing on the moon.
I think
and
that's
you know, and I mean, it is fair, we do need to figure out how to land on the moon because we have what, forgotten?
No, I think, I mean, things are different now. So like the lunar landers that land,
I mean, the moon isn't different. The moon is very much the same, I think.
Still cheese.
When we went up recently, of course, we had people landing them. Most landers now are autonomous, which means they have to be able to do it from a distance. And that's not easy. There's no, you know, PlayStation controller that you can just use to do this. But we are going back. Artemis 4 brings us back there in 2028. So fingers crossed we have an ESA pilot or an ESA
a woman.
Astronaut. Or a woman. Anyone. Great.
Our third story is fascinating, Shane, because it has, it's got that little bit of quirkiness of life to it. It's to do with how humans walk.
Yeah. So we'll all remember Zoolander, that great noughties romp, where one of the kind of key things was that Zoolander himself said he wasn't an ambi-turner. So when he'd go to the bottom, he was a male model, go to the bottom of the walkway and couldn't turn left. He could only turn right. But it turns out that all humans have a preference for going left. So this is really weird. And it was completely discovered by accident. There were Italian scientists that were randomly looking at how many people you could fit in a room during COVID without them kind of continuously bumping into each other. I don't know who took part, but they got people to do
Why
it.
Why would you do that?
PhD students. And they looked at their movement and they saw that kind of in a big ensemble that people tended to go left far more than they do right. They controlled this for gender. For culture, they did it with people in Japan to see do they kind of have the same orientation. They also checked it for people who are left and right-handed. I would have assumed this was the thing, right? You know, if you're right-handed, you'll go to the left. But no, everyone does it, right? It turns out that ants do it too, right? So other creatures, like not even other vertebrates do it. And no idea of the origins. It's just one of those quirky things. Somebody in the paper wrote something hilarious, which was they wondered, would the Australians go the opposite direction? Some sort of weird Coriolis effect.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah, no. Jonathan, no. No. So they too will go to the left. Perhaps it's a biomechanical thing. And I think even though it's only been discovered recently, we've known it for a long time. The first modern Olympics in 1896, people ran around the track in a clockwise direction. The Olympian said it was an unnatural way to run. And since 1913, the Olympics then, an odd year for an Olympics, they have been running anti-clockwise around the track. And that's purely because athletes do not know how to run comfortably the other way around the track.
What?
Yeah.
How do I not know this?
Because you don't hang around with me.
That's mad. This adds to my quirky facts about walking. And that one is if you blind someone, you put them in a field and just tell them to walk, they'll walk in circles into a spiral and eventually...
You mean blindfold people. You don't mean actually people. Blind them.
No, sorry, yeah. Yeah, that would be weird. All right, our final story very quickly, Susan. Sorry, processed foods are bad.
Yeah, I mean, UPFs, we kind of know they're already guilty of causing a number of different diseases, including obesity and increased issues with hearts. But now we're looking at whether or not there's an effect on the brain. Now, I would say, to summarise very briefly, that they studied 2,000 people and they saw that when people ate around a 10% increase in UPF in their diet, that did give a significant reduction in attention. So not memory, but their capacity to do a certain standardized test that studied attention. But I would say one of the things is this causation correlation problem, that they have no baseline sort of on people's attention beforehand. So we don't know whether or not it's people who have maybe poor attention are more inclined to eat UPF, you know, for whatever reason, or the other way around. So they do mention that it, you know, it's out of Monash University in Australia. They do say that, you know, there's need for kind of longitudinal studies in this field. But as I see it, even though it's not the perfect experiment, what I would say is that it's another piece of the puzzle, right, in terms of what UPF may be doing and, you know, kind of adds into the understanding of these types of foods and, you know, how to reduce them in our diet. So definitely needs a little expansion. And the authors say the same thing as well.
We say it all the time, very, you know, we hear it all the time, but actually, you know, thinking about eating ultra processed food, how that's made, what happens to the nutrients in that food, how it's presented to us and how we consume it. You know, it's crazy how these large food companies have managed to dominate our local shops. You know, they talk about food deserts. You know, food deserts in Britain, they talk about that, that actually you can't get healthy food in a 5-mile radius and you end up eating this stuff. There's a shop in Tala near the Tala National Stadium, and it's the closest, you know, nearby local shop. If you walk in there, like the neon colours of all of these ultra-processed food will actually blind you. It's kind of crazy that this is a normal food environment.
Universities are no better and airports the same. Yeah. It can be quite hard to buy healthy food.
Yeah. All right. Susan, Shane, thank you very much. So when we think about the deep past, we often think about, you know, dinosaurs and T-Rexes and woolly mammoths. We don't think about plants. And before we had trees, we had 8-meter high thingies that are absolutely fascinating and seem to be everywhere. They were called prototaxites, And Corentin Laurent is a paleobiologist at Trinity College Dublin. He's here now to explain all about them. So welcome to the programme, Corentin. Tell me a little bit about, just set the scene. What part of our ancient history are we talking about?
So we are at an era where vegetation is at the very beginning. So you start to see vascular plants, so the thing that will lead to the plant we know today, but I still have a lot of mosses around. So the vegetation is about ankle to knee high. And then suddenly if you walk in those landscapes, suddenly you can come across the sort of 5 to 8 meter tall organisms. So it's a very contrasted site at that time, about 400 million years ago.
You call them organisms rather than plants. So I'm interested in that. To actually describe, what do they physically look like? Because 8 meters is enormous.
It's gigantic, yeah. So it's an organism that have been discovered at the end of the 19th century that have been called Prototaxitis, which is in Latin for primitive yew tree, because at first it was interpreted as a rotten bark with like fungi inside. And, you know, time pass and interpretation comes and goes. And people sort of think, oh, it's odd for a plant. So maybe it's a sort of algae, but it's also odd for an algae. So maybe, and this was the sort of consensus in the last 30 years, that it might be a fungus. So the same family than mushrooms. And in terms of anatomy, what you have is a giant bag of spaghetti, basically. It's an organism that is made of tubes and only tubes, organized in a broad directional fashion for some of them, with large ones, smaller ones, some have branching, some have not,
organ in a way.
A spaghetti bowl, really. I think that's the best metaphor you can have for it.
A standing up spaghetti bowl.
Exactly.
Right.
And so this is very peculiar. And fungi do tubes, we know they're made of filaments called mycelium, but not in that fashion and not that big. We don't have 8 meter mushrooms today.
And so how do we know that they look like that? Because no offense to paleobotany or paleobiology, right? But sometimes we're constructing things from a very small amount of information. And as you say, you know, interpretations change over time. How do we know they look like these?
Yeah, so in that case, we have some specimens that are preserved in exceptional conditions. So the work we've been carrying on with my team in Edinburgh before coming here was looking at some of those exceptional preserved specimens from a deposit called the Rhenny Chert in what is today Aberdeenshire, from the town of Rhenny. But at the time, you imagine this was a wetland in a tropical area. And all of the organisms from that environment have been preserved frozen in time in siliceous rock. And thanks to that, we have the 3D organisms preserved, and we can really, really see the internal organization of them. So we see those tubes, we see how they branch and how they orient themselves in space. We have something in three dimension in opposition to some fossil that can be preserved as flattened with no internal morphology. So that's those very, very rare, but also very, very important fossil that allowed us to learn more about how those things were.
What's really interesting about this is you say, you know, the current thinking of the past 30 years is that they're fungi. I mean, with all of the science and technology advancements we've seen over the past, you know, particularly the last 3 decades, how do we not know if this thing was a fungi or not?
Yeah, so the really odd thing is that everybody agreed that this was closer to a fungus than anything else. But even if it was a fungus, this was still odd. There's so many things that was not working.
Like
for
what?
Any of the... So, for example, we don't know exactly what they would have feed, what they would have eat. So fungi would be saprotrophic, so they will eat dead organic matter. But if you're 8 meter at a time where the only food source for you is small plants, you will not have enough to sustain something that big. So that would be peculiar. Another example is the reproductive structure that we still can't know. We still don't know how they were actually reproducing. There's some idea, but this doesn't fit what we observe in some fungi. So even if it is a fungi, then you're lacking some of the key parts to place it in one particular family within the fungi. So everybody sort of agree on that. But the great thing that we have, and you mentioned that, is that since 30 years, the techniques have evolved so much. And what we can do now in those very well-preserved organisms, examples that I cited, for example, is to look at the molecular signal on top of what the morphology is telling us. And this is really what we wanted to carry with our work, which is, can we test the hypothesis that they were fungi using those new techniques coupled with the traditional approaches? And the answer was like, no, we didn't find anything. So it's not back to square one, but this is another, you know, sort of cross on the list, on the tick list of what they could be. So they're two different, also molecularly speaking, to be fungi. So yeah, here we go.
So take me back just for a second, yes, to biology class. We have fungi, we have bacteria, we have archaea, we have animals. Is it possible that this is something else?
So obviously now we have also made incredible advance in genetic, and all of those sometimes concept of what we used to call supergroup is much less clear than it was before, with, you know, categories that are very separate. But
So that's not generally accepted so much anymore?
So we have the category like bacteria, eubacteria, the part of the prokaryotic domain, by opposition to the eukaryotic domain, inside which you'll find the fungi, the animal, us, for example, being animal. And within those eukaryotes, you can sort of vernacularly separate into a supergroup, which sometimes, like algae, doesn't really reflect anything genetically speaking, because algae or green algae and red algae are very close to plants, but what we call brown algae are actually closer to other organisms completely unrelated to plants.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, exactly. So the idea of the tree we have sometimes have to be rethink a bit in terms of what we know on the genetic now. But if you take those big categories, you will have animals and fungi, which are very close together. Fungus are actually mushrooms and all are actually our closest cousin on the tree of life.
Then, really?
On another branch, you'll have the plants, including the green algae, the red algae, and then the plant, the land plant. And then we can maybe do another category with all the rest, which we usually call protists, which mean you're neither an animal, neither a fungi, neither a plant. So it's very broad categories that doesn't especially reflect the genetic.
And who lives in that? What sort of species live in
that?
So,
for example, brown algae. So if you go on the shore, sometimes you find these vesiculosus algae with a bulb. So those are part of that group, but they really look like an algae. But this is a very separate group. Foraminifera as well, the tiny shell fossils you can find in sands. So all of those sort of things. So they are, and a vast majority of those are actually unicellular. So that's come back to, you know, where Prototaxa discat fit, because all the groups, if we take those categories, all the categories that we know are doing sort of massive multicellular stuff, or massive, at least large multicellular structure, like a mushroom, like an animal can do, or like plants. So none of those categories fit, like Prototaxa discat doesn't look like any of those categories.
Huh.
So it might be part of the other things that we know from unicellular, but maybe in the past we're doing something multicellular.
So these prototaxites, these giant, up to 8 meter long tubes, how wide were they, by the way? How thick was the tube?
It could be a couple meter wide, yeah. So you can have 1 meter to 5 meter.
And how wide would a single tube be?
Oh, you mean inside? Oh, this is a couple of micron tube. So it's very small, but they do massive structure. So I think the biggest will be around some sort of like 100 micrometer. So 0.1 millimeter in diameter itself. The tube inside the structure itself.
And sorry, I'm just trying to visualize
the size of the spaghetti.
So these spaghetti sort of stuck together and branching out could be 8 meters wide and a meter, 8 meters tall, a meter wide, but really thin spaghetti.
Exactly. They made, wow. Yeah. So that's why I think the spaghetti metaphor is not too far from the reality. It's
just, so, I mean, this is very long ago. You haven't really figured out whether or not it's a fungus or not yet. I mean, where do you go from here? Like, how do you figure the etymology, the history of this particular animal or plant or whatever it was, and how do you go about understanding how it evolved and what it did?
Yeah, I think it's the sort of moment where taking bottom-up approach is very interesting. So rather than trying to shoehorn it somewhere, maybe we can just look at, you know, what the fossils give us in terms of evidence that lead to how he was living, what he was feeding on, etc. So the molecular information can give us clue about what it was made of. If we know what it was made of, then we can infer, was it standing? How big could it stand? Can you sustain, you know, wind? All of these questions. If you look at how he was interacting with the substrate, then you can start thinking how he would have feed, how we would have interact with other organisms. So I think this is a sort of question that can now be asked and answered with those new type of techniques and new type of approaches, rather than just trying to show on it somewhere. I think we would learn more about it by, you know, exploring rather than say, okay, that's a fungi, let's even oats, but we leave it there, and then we know we do things that fungi do, and that's all. And I think this could be a bit limiting. It's probably one of the many reasons why we still don't know what it is. We might have been too focused on placing it somewhere rather than actually studying every single bit of information from it.
Right. So say, for example, you have this prototaxite, this giant structure, the largest megastructure that we've seen on the planet, right? Yes. So 8 meters is huge. The first
and
before
at the
trees
time,
and
certainly.
Before animals,
yeah, exactly.
Right? Everything else was small, and this thing was massive. Is there a danger by sort of trying to infer, you know, from what it looks like, sort of inferring, you know, like evolutionary psychology has this problem sometimes where we look at a behavior and we say, well, that came out of this behavior because of, you know, the need to have bigger brains or whatever. And sometimes a lot of that can be, you know, certainly earlier on in the field, based on sort of guessing and sort of putting things together. How do we know for sure? Is there digital modeling you can do and see, you know, if we had a structure like this, it would grow this way, and try and figure out how it was the way it was? Or, you know, when you're just dealing with inert rock, how do we unpack that puzzle?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. And I think coming into having this sort of bottom-up approach, like as you said, for example, modeling is one aspect you can do. Obviously, you can say we need more fossils. Obviously, we need more fossils. If we can find fossils, like, preserve where the organism was living, that would be perfect. Sometimes this is very rare, and this haven't happened for prototaxites. But this is the sort of thing, modeling is a thing, looking at the signal that can be preserved within it. This is something that is done from a couple of decades only now. So it's really something that come in handy now, looking with new methods of microscopy, for example, things that can reconstruct the 3D structure itself. So all of this is accessible now and allowed us to gather any sort of information we can have. And then the inference come from looking at, you know, you can look at in ecology, those things would have a function in an ecosystem. Even though they're not represented today, you can think, oh, okay, 8 meter tall a tower will provide shade, it will provide food, it will provide, you know, and all of those
security
sort of things.
For it's animals, yeah.
It's sort of a generic ecological, I don't like to call that law, but, you know, things that's going to be basic principle.
Yeah.
So this is also how you can actually learn of it. Not specially knowing what it is, but knowing what is its function in ecosystem. And I think this you can really do by gathering those information.
In your field, right, I'm just wondering how popular paleobiology as opposed to, you know, paleoanthropology, which is, you know, very human centered and a lot, and actually studying dinosaurs and ancient animals. Mm. Like, is your field a sort of a much more niche and smaller field, or is that changing?
I don't know. I mean, we can talk of the nomenclature of field, or sometimes or can be very, you know, the choice of calling yourself a paleobiologist rather than paleontologist. But I think in my case, and I will talk in my opinion, is that what is my interest? My interest is to learn about how past organisms were living, what were the biology of past organisms. Therefore, I think paleobiology in that case is a very good choice of name. But some people might argue otherwise. And I think it's what's growing in terms of calling yourself a paleobiologist today is really sort of integration of techniques. Looking at things coming from biology, modern biology, you know, genetic insight, all of this, coming from chemistry, physics in terms of the technique you can apply to fossils, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is maybe that's why this field is growing at the moment, but it's a matter of nomenclature, I guess, so, you know, semantic almost.
Yeah. In terms of these, you know, to have something so big, you would need some sort of stability in terms of legs or roots or something. Do we have evidence to know how they were integrated into the ground, how they fed and so on?
Yeah, so at the moment, we don't have any evidence of that. This is only indirect inference. If you're 8 meter high, how do you stand? And you probably need to anchor yourself very strongly in the ground. Now, we don't have evidence of fossil preserve where they were living. So it's very hard to know exactly if this was the case. But there's two things. Yes, standing will require some anchorage, but also feeding. If you indeed a saprotrophic organism and you eat dead organic matter, and there is not much around, you really need to, you know, crawl around and then seek for this food. So that's two clues that will guess that there should be some sort of anchoring.
And we do have fossils from Ireland, right? But not substantial fossils. We don't have enough fossils to fully understand.
So there is fossil from Protodactylitis from all around the world, and it's possibly in Ireland. This is something I'd like to investigate. So far, fragments were reported in the 80s from County Tipperary. So maybe more, maybe there's more to find. So that's definitely something I'd like to pursue.
So finally, in terms of how they, I mean, how do they go extinct? Do we know why we don't see any of these incredible sounding structures on our landscape today?
Well, I think that's the big question here. That will help understand all the rest as well, I think, to a certain extent. They disappear before we see the tree and the forest appearing. So there's two things. Either they like fungi, they were doing saprotrophy, and so fungi are very good at doing saprotrophy and they just outcompete them. So one solution. So they die because the competition was too harsh with the organism feeding in the same way. Or they were occupying a niche that the tree took later. And so they were also outcompeted in an ecological perspective here. So that's two possibilities.
As with almost everything we talk about in the program, so many more questions than we have time to answer. Corentin Laurent, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
No comments from last week's episode. And that's fine, but let's not make a habit of it. If you'd like to text us anything about this show, drop us an email. It's probably easiest. science@newstalk.com. We'll get to them next week. That's it for this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.